And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Globalization, it's everywhere. Today, we take three looks at globalization as we bring you news of an amazing new internet tool that will fly you to literally anywhere on Earth in seconds and let you explore in ways that are astonishing. Then, it's a look at the world from a real globalist perspective, a man whose job it is to make plans for the realities of global warming. And then, we bring you an exclusive story from a Wildside News listener about his discovery of a most amazing example of tool using in animals. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Globalization is sweeping around the world. Okay, it's a bad joke, but we need to remember that it wasn't all that long ago that it took days for news to reach us. Now, we hear about events from around the world in minutes. Before CNN and the global satellite communication systems, reporters and cameramen would have to literally shoot film, put it in a can, drive it to the airport, and fly it to news centers in New York. Now, it's live from almost everywhere. We are truly living in the age of globalization. There are many extraordinary opportunities that come with globalization and many uncertainties. One thing we know for sure, globalization in some form is sweeping around the world. So today, we explore three perspectives on globalization. Following today's news and commentary, you are going to be introduced to a literal manifestation of globalization that will give you the opportunity to travel quickly to literally anywhere on Earth and take a close-up look at what is there. From cities, to your neighborhood, to prairies, parks, islands, mountains, peaks, you can now go anywhere in the world in seconds. In our second segment, we talk to a real globalist whose job it is to take a close look at what the effects of globalization will have on the planet, because his bank, the World Bank, will be responsible for financing the future of the developing world, and he has a lot to say about how the World Bank is looking at global warming and climate change. You just may be surprised at what he has to say. Then in segment 3, from one of my listeners from Tel Aviv, thanks to the global internet, you get an exclusive breaking nature story about an extraordinary discovery of crows that figured out how to catch fish in a most ingenious way. It's all coming up as we span the globe to keep you up to the minute in the news we need to make informed decisions about the future of life on Earth. So first, the news. Despite an almost total news blackout on the story, last week's oil spill is proving to be the largest oil spill along Alaska's North Slope. The spill, estimated at 267,000 gallons, seeped into the snow-covered tundra. Crews are busy sucking up the mess with temperatures more than 70 degrees below zero, which offers a small blessing as the crude is now the consistency of honey. British Petroleum claims responsibility for the spill, which occurred from a 1/2-inch hole in the pipeline due to corrosion inside the 3-mile line that leads to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. The legendary Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia, renowned as one of the finest diving areas for the amazing coral life, is now estimated to be 98% devoid of life. The corals appear as an endless white and lifeless landscape. Scientists attribute this dramatic change to the record high temperatures in the waters that make up the reef, reaching 84 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the upper limit for coral. This follows on 2005, which saw a major bleaching of the corals of the Caribbean. With ocean temperatures on the rise, little change in this condition is seen in the near future. Corals are vital as spawning grounds for many species of fish and help prevent coastal erosion and serve as a strong economic engine from revenues from tourists. And badminton players around the world, particularly professional badminton players, are expected to have to pay higher prices for the shuttlecocks due to, of all things, a shortage of goose feathers in China as one of the effects of the bird flu. The price of professional goose feather shuttlecocks has risen 25% in the last year, and prices are expected to continue to rise. The retail price of a championship-grade feather shuttlecock is currently $1.75. This is yet another example of the price we must all pay for globalization. And that's the news. A few reminders. One of the big stories this week was the resignation of Interior Secretary Gail Norton. Without much fanfare and even less press scrutiny, Gail Norton announced her resignation last week, and she'll be gone by the end of the month. At this time, no replacement has been named. Secretary Norton claims she is resigning for personal reasons. However, some have speculated that she resigned because of some possible association with the Abramoff scandal. And that's about as far as it will likely go. But I want to remind my listeners that way back in January, I went out on a limb to suggest that there was a potentially questionable, politically incestuous faction within the Department of Interior that had direct connections with Abramoff and included Gail Norton directly. And I encourage any reporters out there who want a real story to just do a little research on the following players. First, Chad Calvert, Undersecretary of the Interior, appointed by Gail Norton, who arbitrarily lifted the protections for Tetchupuk Lake in Alaska with a stroke of his pen. He was one of the first Bush appointees and worked with the Bush-Cheney transition team and focused on the interior. His wife Jennifer, currently working for Washington Strategies, a D.C. lobbying firm that has amongst its reputed political successes planting the story about a secret affair between John Kerry and a reporter, but more directly, Jennifer Calvert worked directly with the Abramoff lobbying firm for years. Also in Washington Strategies is Bill Jarrell, who worked as well for Abramoff and prior to that served under George Bush Sr. with the Interior Department. It's an amazing story, one which I hope we will be able to cover in depth in the months ahead, because as yet, it has gone unreported, except for a few hard-to-find places, but more specifically, here on the Wild Side News. So if this interests you, let me know what you find out. We'll report it on your Voice of the Earth, here on the Wild Side News. Well, now let's turn our attention to something truly at the other extreme. Please get a piece of paper and take some notes, or revisit today's webpage later on for the links. But here is one of the most sensational benefits of globalization I've found in a very long time. Anyone listening to this show has heard of Google. Google, which recently went public and then proceeded to take an astronomical jump in value, is an amazing bunch of folks. They are on a stated mission to make all information available online. I use Google about 50 times a day to find out information on just about everything or anything at all that I find interesting. Recently, somehow, I stumbled onto a new Google feature called Google Earth. I have a link to the site on today's show page. And if you can find it easily by going to www.earth.google.com. Google Earth makes it possible to choose any place on Earth by putting in a search string and then watching as a real image of our Earth begins to whirl about and then begins to bring you closer and closer to that precise spot using extremely high-definition satellite images of the entire Earth. In order to use this feature from your computer, you do need to download a free Google Earth program that supports your Quest. Coming from Google, you have little to fear in terms of viruses. I have links to the download site on today's show page, and it works with computers running Windows 2000 or XP, and there is a Mac version as well. Once you've done that and loaded the program onto your computer, then it's a matter of typing in some place you want to visit, hitting the search icon, and then the magic journey begins. In the upper right sector of the Google Earth page is a picture of the Earth. Once you initiate the search, the Earth starts to spin, and in a few short seconds brings you to that place with actual images of that spot. You can then zoom in for greater detail or zoom out for a wider perspective. To zoom in, you simply left double-click and it begins to move in closer. To stop, you left-click again. You can continue doing this and get closer and closer and closer with actual images. I've spent hours getting to know my Earth, my neighborhood, cities from around the world, places I have been, places I want to go. So first, I encourage each of you to go on board with Google Earth by downloading the program. Then you will be able to literally go anywhere your heart or mind desires. And it's all so very personal. For me, I'm fascinated by the patterns of the Earth, and they are truly sensational from this perspective using the Google Earth search system. And what's also amazing about Google Earth is that by cleverly using your mouse, you can initiate the effect of flying over the landscape to survey everything from a flight from Arizona to Montreal, from any altitude you wish, to flying just over the tops of the twisted dry canyon walls of Canyonlands National Park. What makes Google Earth truly spectacular is the detail that is available to you. I decided to check where a friend of mine lives in New York. I typed in his address and then launched, and watched as I flew directly over his neighborhood. And then I left-clicked repeatedly until I was literally looking down to the street right in front of his apartment in New York City. I continued to left-click until I finally reached a point where I could make out individual cars and people on the street at the moment that particular photo was taken. And it's all in wonderful color. Then by double right-clicking, I could zoom back out and away. And then, if I want to, I can fly off to explore the city or the countryside or across the ocean to England or Beijing or Thailand. They also have special features of special interest to many. While I was exploring the landscapes of China, for example, I noted the Forbidden City in Beijing, highlighted with an imaginary tag. The Forbidden City. Of course I had to go there. I was able to explore the Forbidden City from the perspective of looking at the entire moat-protected space with its corner towers for protection. Then I zoomed in until I could make out the palace, the main square, with individual people walking about. It's also possible to do visual surveys of areas we read about, areas like Anwar or Teshikpuk Lake. It's significant to be able to literally see the thousands of interconnecting lakes and understand why drilling could be so dangerous there. I did a story a few weeks back on the natural gas fields of New Mexico around Aztec that Tweety Blanchett talked about recently. So, using Google Earth, I flew over to Aztec and was stunned to see the reality. Like the white strands of a spider web, I could literally see the endless matrix of pipelines connecting the little white dots of gas wells that spread throughout whole sections of the region. It told the story more effectively than anything I'd read about or heard. Then I wondered if I could use this for really practical things, like heading off into the boundary waters of northern Minnesota with its thousands of interconnecting lakes. Sure enough, there it was, every single lake and island. I thought what a benefit it would be if I could actually print those out before an adventure, and that is precisely what you can do by clicking on File, then Save Image. Now, you can adjust the image to enhance the three-dimensional effects of your wanderings by going to Tools and then clicking on Options. if you set your elevation exaggeration, which is one of the choices, to 3, get set for a stunning deepening of the landscape in which steep-walled canyons create dizzying drops. The wonder of this planet has never been more accessible. I've put links on today's show, and I've posted a couple of examples of images that I've taken from Google Earth. This is, to my thinking, one of the most powerful nature tools ever developed, and opens up a desire for exploration and a resource for learning, and perhaps most importantly, at least for me, is a fully accessible, totally free means to get a real sense of what globalization means in its most fundamental sense of the word. Am I impressed? Yes. And I want to commend the people at Google for making Google Earth a reality, for making it so easy to use and download, and for making it available to everyone and anyone who wants to use it, absolutely free. Go to www.earth.google.com. Globalization from 3 perspectives. In a moment, we travel to Washington, D.C., and talk with a real live globalist when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Globalization. Good for the planet? Bad for the planet? It probably depends on your perspective. For those who see the roots of globalization formed in the secret societies of the 18th century, whose dreams for a one-world government were held and carried out by the secret hands of the Illuminati or the Freemasons, globalization may not be your cup of tea. Or was it the dreams of the wild-eyed intellectuals like the Dulles brothers who formed the seedling CIA? Or is it a natural evolution of life on Earth? Or the spiritual expression of the oneness of all humanity? Whatever it is, it's happening. And we talk with a real live globalist when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Say what you will about globalization, but the truth is, it's happening whether we like it or not. And the truth is, there are those whose job it is to deal with the effects of globalization because it is and will continue to have dramatic impact on the developing world, which will be pulled into this global change because they literally have no choice. One aspect of a globalizing world is now being felt as global warming or climate change. And some would say this is just some people talking. But for those whose job it is to look at the future and determine what consequence global warming could have on societies, cultures, villages, and indigenous people who will be faced with dealing with these effects, we go straight to the source to find out. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Robert T. Watson. He's the senior scientist and senior advisor with the World Bank. Dr. Watson, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
You've been involved with issues relating to global warming, actually going back to the time when global warming was probably first being discussed. Give us a brief intro to how it is that you come to this focus.
Yeah, I first focused much of my work on an issue called stratospheric ozone depletion, which is where we humans are destroying the ozone layer above us, leading to an increase of ultraviolet radiation at the Earth's surface, which then led to an increase in skin cancer cases. I then suddenly recognized that climate change was probably an even larger problem. And so in the late 1980s, I started to get involved in this issue of to what degree are we humans changing the Earth's climate and what are the implications of those changes to society.
As you know, this topic is one that has many different interpretations as to its real significance, et cetera, et cetera. At this point, where does the World Bank come in terms of its recognition of the significance of global warming?
Yeah, the World Bank recognizes it is a serious issue. There's absolutely no doubt the Earth's climate is changing, and it also is quite clear that most of that change is due to human activities. It's equally clear that the Earth's climate will continue to change over the coming decades, over the coming century. The reason the World Bank is extremely concerned about this issue is that climate change is likely to undermine our main goals of poverty alleviation and economic development in developing countries. The real concern is that climate change could adversely affect agricultural productivity in developing countries, adversely affect water resources, lead to an increase in sea level, potentially displacing tens of millions of people. Also, it could actually adversely affect human health through an increase in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever or cholera, a waterborne disease in developing countries. So the reason the bank takes this issue seriously is we recognize that it could undermine development.
In terms of short-term risks that you feel the bank is going to have to start to address, what would you say are some of those short-term risks?
There's two approaches that we need to work with our developing country clients. First is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That is to say, make sure they get the energy they need for economic development, but try and do it in a climate-friendly way. And in particular, two countries are increasing their generation of electricity, for example, at an incredible rate, India and China. So our first short-term goal is to work with India and China to try and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions from their electricity sector. Secondly is adaptation. Here what we recognize is that many of our client countries are maladapted to today's climate variability. That is to say their agricultural systems, their water resource systems are actually not resilient to today's climate variability. So our first goal is to first understand how to help our developing country clients become less vulnerable to current climate variability, and then effectively, how can we make sure they're less vulnerable to long-term climate change? And the key issues are sea level rise in low-lying deltaic areas or small island states. And the second issue is how to make sure the agriculture and water sectors are resilient to climate variability and climate change.
It would be instructive if you have any examples where you're beginning to really have to address this at this point already.
Well, certainly we're already working with some low-lying areas such as in Bangladesh, a small Pacific island called Kiribati, to think through when sea level starts to rise significantly, what are their options? Do they retreat inland? Do they try and build seawall defenses? What options do they have? Now, Bangladesh has got options in the sense it's a fairly large country. But unfortunately, it's a very low-lying deltaic area where millions of Bangladeshis live. It's also where much of their agricultural productivity is. It's a very complex deltaic system. And so it's not clear what ensemble of strategies of retreat, building seawall defenses, will actually work. But there is a dialogue going on to actually understand what are the best options for the country. In a small country like Kiribati, we're trying to think through again what the options are, but this is a series of very low-lying atolls that sort of spread out across the Pacific Ocean where the highest point is only 1 meter high. And so they've got some real challenges of how to even deal with it, and we're working with them to think through what some of the options might be. We have a major study in India to think through how is the agricultural sector in India and the water resources sector in India already being affected by climate variability, and how might that effectively get even worse in the future. So we're trying to understand what are the coping strategies that can be developed to make the agricultural sector in India far less vulnerable to fluctuations in climate and more extreme events, etc.
There's many organizations around the world that are addressing this in various forms. How is it that the World Bank will play into these strategies to deal with these challenges?
The World Bank will work with all of the other major players, of course, especially the United Nations Environment Programme, the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO in Rome, the World Health Organization in Geneva. Our major role is in implementing projects on the ground. And given that we have to work on the energy sector, the agricultural sector, the water sector, one of the issues we're looking at is to what degree are the projects that we're involved in, to what degree are they climate sensitive? In other words, are these projects, if the climate were to change, it would undermine the efficacy of the project? So we're building a screening tool that simply asks the question, on all of the projects we have on any sector throughout the world, is that project sensitive to a changing climate? And if it is, how could we redesign that project to be climate proof, in other words? So we're trying to do that work, but we do collaborate closely with the other regional development banks, such as the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank. We're clearly trying to work much closer with the private sector, who are major players, of course, in development across the world. So we see our role is working with partners, both in other forms of international organizations and the private sector, and continuing a dialogue with our client countries on how to help them climate-proof their investments.
In terms of developing countries in particular, what specific areas do you think they should be addressing to deal with these problems?
Well, the most sensitive areas in the world tend to be the low-lying deltaic areas, small island states. They need to deal with the whole issue of sea level rise. But most countries in Africa are extremely vulnerable to a change in climate. And therefore, I would argue the highest priorities in many of the countries in Africa, certain parts of Asia and Latin America, is how to deal with the risk to water resource management and agricultural productivity. One of the basic problems is that throughout the tropics and subtropics, any increase in temperature is likely to lead to a decrease in agricultural productivity, especially in some of the areas where we already have famine and hunger today. Secondly, all of the theory suggests that areas that are already dry, the arid and semi-arid areas throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, are likely to become drier in the future. The wet areas are likely to become wetter. And so the challenge is how to manage our water resources in areas where they're already dry today, they're likely to get even less rainfall. And those that already have probably as much or too much rainfall are going to get even more. So I would argue the two highest priority areas are managing water resources and agriculture. And then, as I say, on the low-lying areas, dealing with sea level rise.
Therefore, when you look out 25 years and even 50 years, which is what people in the World Bank are confronted, you have to do that. You have to be thinking out that far. As I look at this, if this were my job, I would say we're facing some real challenges, particularly as we look at this trade-off between alleviating poverty and promoting development. And because unfortunately at this point, the development, particularly as we watch China and India emerge, that seems to be focused around a fairly consumerist form of economic advance. And as you well know, that's where the rubber meets the road. We cannot just continue to consume. And therefore, there has to be some potential change of vision into a more sustainable global economy. Tell us what your thoughts are in that regard.
I mean, the two challenges are, first, how do we get energy, modern energy, to the 2 billion people throughout the world that don't have any access to modern energy services today? Many of these people, many of them in Africa, certain parts of Asia, their only form of heating is burning dung or traditional biomass, sort of wood. And when they burn it inside their homes, it leads to very high levels of air pollution, indoor air pollution, and literally millions of young children and women die every year. So the first challenge is to make sure they get energy for poverty alleviation. What we have to try and do is make it as clean as possible. in what we call our middle income developing countries, such as India and China, they have a huge appetite for energy, not only for poverty alleviation, but for strong economic growth. The challenge there is, how can they get the energy they need for poverty alleviation and economic growth, but in a clean form? And in fact, we're working with them literally as we talk. And the question is, as they increase their demand for electricity, how do we make sure that their coal-fired generation plants are the most efficient in the world? And over the next 5, 10, 20 years, can we even modify those plants with what we call carbon capture and storage, so we don't even release the carbon dioxide from a thermal coal-fired power plant into the atmosphere? It's a technology that's just becoming available. It probably won't be commercially available really throughout the world for another 10 or 20 years. But we're thinking through, how does one provide clean energy that actually eliminates local air pollution and protects the climate system? And so the two sides of the story are the generation of energy. The other side of the story is the use of energy. Transportation is increasing rapidly in many developing countries, especially in India and China. How do we make sure the cars that are on the road are the most efficient you can get? How do we have mass transportation so people can use mass transportation, not individual vehicles? How can we have better land use planning so people don't have to drive or travel so far to work? And so the transportation sector is a very critical sector, but not only in developing countries. It's a critical sector in the USA, in Europe. We're increasing our use of transportation. So how can we have a better transportation system, increase use of mass transport? And the second area on the use of energy is in the buildings. How can we make the buildings as efficient as possible and the appliances we have inside the buildings as efficient as possible? So in our dialogue with developing countries, we do talk about how do we produce the energy in the cleanest possible fashion, and we also ask the question, how can we use it in the most efficient way? If we can make progress on both sides of that equation, we can have the energy we need for poverty alleviation and economic growth without severe impacts on both local air quality as well as on the climate system.
Certainly, we see a lot of interest these days in clean energy sources, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera, but to address this, particularly the energy side of this, do you feel perhaps that the world really needs to address at even at a much larger scale the development of these clean tech sources?
Yes, what we have to recognize is all of the projections suggest that over the next 10, 20 years, much of the energy will still be from coal, oil, and gas. So the first challenge is, how do we effectively make our utilization of coal, oil, and gas as clean as possible? Very efficient coal-fired power plants. We try to capture the carbon dioxide from these power plants. How do we make the use of oil in cars as efficient as possible? But in parallel to that, we have to try and work on scaling up our renewable energy sources. As you've said, solar, wind, geothermal, etc. Today, with the exception of large hydropower systems, modern renewable energy only accounts for about 3% of total energy production. So even if we double it or triple it in the next 10 or 20 years, it's still only going to be 6 or 10% of the total energy produced in the world. So we need to do research and development, and we have to get what we'll call the prices right to make sure that as we develop these new technologies, there's a way for them to penetrate into the marketplace. So we need a strategy of improving the technologies we've got today, trying to make them as efficient as possible, more research and development to improve the technologies, but we've got to get what I call the prices right. So as we do get more renewable energy technologies to be commercially viable, they are used. And one of the problems at the moment is we have huge subsidies in many parts of the world on fossil fuels, which actually limits the penetration of these clean energy technologies into the marketplace.
How do you see the World Bank really involved in creating really a whole new vision for sustainability on this planet? You're just one, you're a big organization, but you are just one. How do you interface and really unite all the various players in this? Because from my perspective personally, it's something that we simply must do.
Well, at the last G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland last year, they asked the World Bank to try to put together an investment framework to deal with clean energy and development. They asked us to work with the other regional banks. They asked us to work with the private sector. and they were asked us to work with the International Energy Agency. So we're actually in the middle of developing an investment framework, and we've literally put it in sort of what I call three steps. First is, how do we get energy that is clean from a local and regional perspective to developing countries? And what are those technologies? What are the policies that are needed? What's the role of the World Bank? What's the role of the private sector? What's the role of our other regional banks? Then we ask the question, what additional do we have to do to make it climate friendly? So what do we need to do from a technology standpoint and a policy standpoint? And then we also ask ourselves the third question, given that we cannot stop climate change, it's already occurring, and some future climate change is already inevitable, how can we work with our client countries and the private sector and the other international organizations to adapt to climate change? So we're right in the middle of developing this paper at the moment, which addresses exactly what you're talking about. What is the role bank, the role of the World Bank? How can we work with the private sector? How do we work with other governments and with other international organizations to try and come up with a vision for clean energy? As we develop this paper, we've already been working with what we call the G+5. That's the five largest developing countries, China, India, Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa. We've already had detailed conversations with them, both with respect to energy generation and adaptation to climate change. And in the next sort of 6 to 9 months, we will expand our conversation with a very large range of developing countries to understand their vision for the future, their need for energy, their concerns about climate change. And as we do talk with developing country clients, we will simultaneously be working with the private sector and the other international organizations.
Dr. Watson, if people want to find out your role in all of this, and by the way, you're a very articulate spokesman, and you're creating a really, I think, a wonderful perspective on what we're facing here and how the world has to unite, how can they find out more about that?
As soon as we've got this vision document more prepared, we will actually be putting it on a web system for people to actually comment. But they could go to the World Bank website, and they could actually look up, sort of go to the site that talks about our environmental projects, and go to the site that talks about our energy projects, and they can still soon get a very good idea of what we're trying to do in the energy sector, what we're trying to do in the environment sector. So we do have a website that has actually some very good descriptions of what our visions are for both energy and environment. And as soon as we've further developed this paper on clean energy and development, we'll be putting that on a website, and actually we'll be soliciting comments from people as well.
Very good. Well, I know you're a very busy man. I can tell in our conversation here. Dr. Robert Watson, senior scientist and senior advisor with the World Bank, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Global warming. It's real. Now, we need to deal with it. When we return, we take a spin around the world to hear an exclusive report on a newly discovered amazing example of tool-using animals when we look at bait-fishing crows. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
When it comes to placing the blame for global warming, we can only blame we humans, because we, with our great genius and inventive capacity, have built the great cities and the elegant cars and the billions of neat things, and wrenched the coal and oil from the ground and tied it all together with a digitally interconnected, interdependent world of commerce, war, and we, the toolmakers, the definition of humanness, or so we say. But the myth of the toolmakers is being challenged by other toolmakers not of the human species. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News. Thanks to the wonders of globalization, I have listeners from all over the world. It's truly amazing, and it's exciting. And this last week, I opened up a short email with the following message. Dear Wildside News, I think you may find the following site interesting. It shows video clips of crows using bread to fish. This is a unique form of tool using previously unknown in crows. Yours, Dr. Oren Hassan, Tel Aviv. So I followed the link and read the material from Dr. Hassan, and I'm thrilled to be able to reveal this amazing observation by one of my listeners, who kindly agreed to let me bring this story to you. Now, scientists for a very long time believed that animals were incapable of making or using tools. Tool use, that is, using something from the environment either naturally occurring or crafted by the animal to serve a useful function, was considered a defining characteristic of humanness. But then laboratory experimenters began to provide observations that certain animals, especially chimpanzees and primates, were capable of using a tool to meet their needs. The classic example of a chimpanzee using a stick to knock down or pull over some bananas that were out of reach. It suggested an adaptive capacity to apply some level of logic and reason on the part of animals to control their world. And once certain scientists acknowledged these findings, well, then others followed. But the examples of tool using, in all honesty, are few and far between. Many people have seen the videos of chimpanzees stripping leaves down to the stem with their mouths and then using the spine of a leaf to lure ants out of an anthill, which were then nibbled off by the chimps. And that amazing series of experiments with New Caledonian crows from the South Pacific island chain unquestionably demonstrate the capacity for crows on this island to craft a variety of tools from twigs, which they used for, again, pulling food or pushing food to eat. In a most amazing example, captured on video, a Caledonian crow takes a straight piece of wire which wouldn't work to get him his food, then holds it with one foot and bends it around a curved surface to make a hook with which he could pull his food from the tube. And there are a few other examples, but they are few and far between. So new discoveries have great significance in the world. Well, today, I'm happy to share with you an amazing example of tool use and conceivably making by once again crows, in this case, from Tel Aviv. Crows are considered in the scientific world right at the top of the animal kingdom for their capacity to solve complex problems. And certainly making tools is a complex behavior for most animals. Dr. Oren Hassan is trained as an animal behaviorist, so probably cannot keep himself from watching the world through this prism. What Dr. Hassan observed while talking to a friend while sitting on a bench in a public park, well, I'd like to read his story. This is from his website, describing how his discovery came about. I was lucky enough to sit one afternoon with a friend of mine by a small circular pool about 15 meters in diameter in a park in Ramat Gan, a city neighboring Tel Aviv. Then a hooded crow came by, landed on a lamp in the center of the pool just above the water with a piece of bread in its bill. It put the bread under its leg and started to shred it to pieces, putting the crumbs in the water, then retrieving the wet crumbs and eating them. I thought that was pretty neat, and showed it to my non-biologist friend. The crow finished eating the bread and left the pool. However, based on the crow's focus of attention, I suspected there was more in that behavior than met the eye. Luckily, my friend and I were engaged in a long conversation. About an hour and a half later, the same or another crow arrived also with a piece of bread in its bill to the very same lamp, doing the same thing. However, this time, while doing this, it suddenly stuck its head in the water and grabbed a fish, a small cichlid. It then took off with the fish in its bill and landed on the grass to eat it. This was something special. Crows and ravens are known to be very clever, but this was beyond what I knew is known about them. The minimum I could do, therefore, was to visit this place a few more times, document the phenomenon, and try to make an estimate of the extent this behavior was spread among the dense crow community living in that park. Dr. Hawson then assembled some professional video equipment and was able to capture two stunningly well-documented video clips, one of the crow bait fishing without catching a fish, and the second in which the bird actually succeeds in luring a fish to its bread bait, then grabs it quickly from the water. I have links on today's website, and you will definitely want to watch each one. Dr. Hassan continues to describe his approach. So here are my brief conclusions. In addition to this particular pool, there is a large artificial pond in the park in which there are many fish. Fishermen regularly arrive to this pond to fish, little egrets, night herons, pied kingfishers, kingfishers, and white-throated kingfishers are among the common fish-eating birds that hunt fish in it, and there are a number of places that could be used by crows as a perch to catch fish. So there was a chance that many crows practiced this behavior, depending perhaps on how long ago it was first learned. To test this, I spread slices of bread all over the park to see how crows handle them. The result was that crows do what crows do, namely, they ate all pieces of bread on the spot. It was only near that particular small pool that I have seen this phenomenon again. As this was at the beginning of the crow's breeding season, and as there were two nests that were built at the time on two adjacent sycamore trees next to the pool, I suspected, by following these unmarked crows, that there was only a single crow, possibly two, one of each nest, which are using the bait fishing technique. One way or another, it was a rare phenomenon. Altogether, my own bait, slices of bread spread around the pool, worked well. I have seen about 10 crows attempt to use bread bait to lure fish, all on the very same perch, and 4 of them were successful. I managed to document 2 of them with my 200mm camera, and the other with a very good digital video camera recorder that I rented for this purpose. Given my equipment, and given that the crow was not tame enough to fish when I was at the edge of the pool, the only way I could do this was by leaving the VCR continuously recording on a tripod while watching the pool from a distance. The two files that I put here are the result of this low-tech effort. One shows an unsuccessful attempt, the other a successful one, pretty much like the first time I saw the crows doing it. Observations were made during March 2000, except for the time I used video, which is on April 5th, 2000. Final words from Dr. Hassan. Bait fishing behavior is now almost certainly extinct among the park's crows population. The small pool has been empty for several years, and when there was water in it, its level was sometimes too low to reach from the perch, or had no fish in it. Hence, my documentation is probably the only one available for such an amazing behavior of wild crows. Dr. Hassan expands on his original research on his website at www.orenhassan.com/EN. I'll repeat that, www.orenhassan.com/EN. I have links to Dr. Hassan's website on today's show page, where you can see these excellently produced videos of these behaviors in which you can compare an unsuccessful bait fishing versus a successful bait fishing by the crow. I believe this will become soon a textbook example of tool use in animals. I congratulate Dr. Hassan for his phenomenal observational acumen, his professional approach to documenting such, and personally wish to thank him for bringing it to my attention. I believe that animals are extremely complex and capable of amazing behaviors. I, like Dr. Hassan, am an animal behaviorist by nature, and therefore pay close attention to the animals around me. And when I observe something out of the ordinary, I pay very close attention. I have two original observations that I'm going to share with you. One involves flies. Yes, the common fly. And the other involves ants. Today, I want to share my ant story and video. And at another time, I'll tell the story of the flies. A couple years back, rather late at night, I was in my art studio in San Diego when I noticed a stream of ants traveling along the front edge of my metal sink. Something, however, caught my eye, something unusual about their behavior. So I began looking more carefully and discovered something almost comical. There was one ant getting a lot of attention because she was stuck to the sink. And quite specifically, only her two hind feet were stuck like glue to the sink. I watched for some time. Sometimes one ant would take the lead, tugging here and there, tapping its feelers all over. Then at times others would join in, each one assessing the situation and offering their strategy to get this ant's feet unstuck. At a certain point, I got my video camera and began recording the event, and thanks to the macro lens, was able to get very close. I posted a rather lengthy version of the video, over 30 minutes, which you can click to see. It's amazing how human this story becomes, as the stuck ant allows its comrades to pull and pull and tug and pull for well over an hour to no avail. At times, the little ant seems so humanesque, and its struggle so exhausting, that it stirs very human feelings for this individual ant. But more to the point, one has to marvel at the efforts by the series of rescuers. It's amazing to see what appears to be some very critical observation by these rescuers, which includes such things as tracing the victim's hind leg with their jaws down to the point where the foot is stuck. It is also amazing to watch as an ant grabs the victim carefully by the neck and pulls to the point where you're sure the poor ant will break. At times, after considerable efforts, an ant will give up, and the poor victim lies vanquished and forlorn and exhausted. Then we see new ants come up and begin to revive it with various grooming and perhaps even feeding. And throughout the entire process, the ant is never injured by its helpers, as if they know the limits. There is a surprise ending that tells a wholly different and amazing ending to the whole story. And I have to admit that for a while after my encounter with the ant, I had an entirely different feeling about them, which unfortunately has drifted with time. I titled the piece Compassion Ants, because that is definitely the feeling it gives to me. So I encourage you to click on the link for compassion ants, and of course for bait fishing crows, and form your own opinions. And I also have a link to send me an email with your comments, which I certainly appreciate. As we become ever more isolated from close communion with the wild creatures, it becomes ever more acceptable to lose our sense of wonder towards these miraculous beings, be they chimpanzees, crows, and even ants. And yet, their individual struggles are in so many ways so similar to our own, which just goes to make the point that this world is in reality an infinitely complex, interconnected, interdependent, billions-year-old miracle. It's a new perspective on globalization. This is Sidney Wildsmith, saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.